Good morning, good afternoon, Tara Kavanagh. This has been a long time coming. How are you today?
Good, very good. Happy to be here.
So this is our first time actually speaking in real life. We have just exchanged comments on LinkedIn back and forth. So some people may think we actually know each other, we've met, and we were just talking before we hit record. It is a weird, maybe it's like a COVID hangover, but how many people that we all, you know, communicate with now and we regularly go back and forward and comment on, but we actually haven't met the vast majority of them. Like, you'd be in the same boat with like a lot of the Shamrock guys. You haven't actually met a lot of them in person or in real life.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So, but again, that was a good habit we maybe learned from COVID, was just getting used and getting comfortable with all this technology and gizmos. But Tara, I'm really, really grateful because as we've mentioned a thousand times before, the whole point of this podcast really is just to get different people's perspectives on a lot of the challenges around asset recovery, and really hear from practitioners that have worked in a variety of different roles, and also to teach people and let people hear from just maybe different people from different departments or backgrounds that they wouldn't have normally sort of encountered. So could we maybe kick off by you giving us your, I'm not even going to do justice to your LinkedIn resume, but maybe give us your story. How did you end up in the Tara, you know, International FinCrime Crime Fighting Extraordinaire? Walk us through how you started your asset recovery journey and what brought you to where you are today.
Yeah, of course. I started with Humint on the ground overseas. This is Iraq and Syria. Then I'm back here, school, took a break, and then went back to it. and I did a lot of ISIS tracking. I was the one on the team who found, for some reason, Google Plus. Was it Google Plus? It was a thing.
Yeah, I think I was the old. It's now been discontinued, but it was Google Plus. Yeah, the big red plus. I can remember.
And on Google Plus were all these people just posting everything that they were doing, from beheadings to, well, here's what I'm going to do next. Here's my, you know, if you want to donate to the cause. It was, you know.
What sort of year is this? Just to place it for people.
This is 2017, right when, you know, everything was, they were very active.
Yeah,
to say the least. So it was very graphic. It was great work because we were, you know, working with this customer and, you know, counterintelligence, and we were generating these reports and people were on the ground responding, and we felt good about what we did. The content itself was, we kept telling our boss, like, can we bring in some kind of animal or something for emotional support? You know, because it was just so tough to see these
it's
videos.
Such a horrific, it's such a horrific topic. Yeah.
And then, you know, after that, I needed a change. So I actually moved a little further out from where I was in Virginia with this agency, and I joined the agency where people are known to be very introverted. there's this joke about, like, only looking down at your shoes, and if you're an extrovert, you look at someone else's shoes or feet. the NSA is a wonderful agency. And that's where cryptography started. Right. I was working with signal intelligence at the time, and really just diving a deep dive into nuanced language, just teaching the folks there how to really listen in on these conversations, because this is still counterintelligence. But now, of course, with the NSA, we're listening in. Right. Mm-hmm. So we had to hone in our listening and really understand, like, all the different dialects and things. So that was really fun for me. It was great. One day I just, after, in 2021 is when I got the call, and somebody said, hey, we have this position, you know, it's with postal inspection. I had never heard of postal inspection. I know about the mail. I use the mail just like everybody else, but I didn't know that they were federal agents, you know, who could kick in your door with, you know, warrants and arrest people. This was all very new to
me. Guns and badges. Like, for international people and listening, and we're gonna dive into that, but just quickly on that point, like, yeah, most people hear, like, postal inspection service and think, you know, mail intercept, and maybe that's the height of it. But, like, in the US, it's guns and badges and warrants and all sorts.
Yeah, very similar to FBI, because I mean that's the one big example you want to give because everybody knows the FBI, you know. But yes, and it was just a pivoting point for me. You know, that's when it became more technical. I was introduced to crypto, so I started with their analytics team, a team of fantastic analysts with various backgrounds, very, very smart people. And if you can imagine, we are working all cases under the purview of the post office. And so everything that can be illicit activity through the mail is something that we looked at and investigated. So if you have check fraud, if you're sending ghost guns, if you are actually scamming people, all sorts of scams, romance scams. And of course, you know, when I started, it was a year after the pandemic, and that's when we were dealing with the stimulus check fraud. So if you
Of course.
remember, yes,
Wow.
in the US, you know, because people were out of jobs, and so the government gave out these stimulus checks, I think every month for a while.
And it's a tribute. I think I was reading the Chainalysis thing recently, and it was like one of the things that caused like the crypto rally. There was all of these like exactly correlated crypto purchases roughly at the time. You could see these exchange wallets or these wallets just being like filled with just know what a coincidence. It's like stimulus check on a Tuesday, someone buys like, was it $1,500 or $2,500 or some really specific amount. Oh yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, and so Eric Holder, is it someone on that I follow on Facebook? He does these deep dives into Telegram, and he's always sharing. If anybody listening is curious to know more about that, there is a whole index of language used just for check fraud. You know, words that they use. You know, if it's an innie, if somebody, it's on the inside that's helping them. Glass is for checks, fraudulent checks. I don't know why glass. And those are things that I had to learn myself. You know, this was 3 years ago, and then I switched to being a liaison for the for postal inspection. So now, a couple days a week, I actually have the pleasure of going into the FBI headquarters building, and I sit in with this task force that is all these other agencies. We all sit together. We each have an agent there. A representative, and we work to combat dark web opioid vendors. So we're looking at dark web cases, vendors, even buyers, and we are trying to stop the overdose. You know,
Fendel
and that's what started the whole thing. Is the DOJ stood up this program, I think in 2015, to combat the opioid crisis. We're not seeing it anymore. And the reason why, and this is one of the saddest things I've heard, is because we topped that number. It cannot go any higher. The people have already died, and that's why we're not seeing overdose cases as many of them anymore. It's because we've
Good
just
God.
hit the highest. Yes. And so we're not seeing it anymore, like I said, but it still happens. And it's really interesting. I could talk about it for days because you're looking at these rogue vendors who are doing it on their own. You know, they're getting their own machinery for press and all this other stuff. Easy to get, you know, through China, all sorts of ways to do this. And of course, they're paying with crypto. They're getting paid in crypto. And these are the people that are more likely to have contaminated drugs. You know, when they sell you the stuff, they may not even know it themselves, but you know, it would be laced with fentanyl or too much fentanyl or something synthetic, and that's how the kids are dying, you know.
Good
And so
God.
we're trying to stop those people, but at the same time, we're still looking at cartel because that's not going away. And
No.
those are the much more convoluted cases where it takes months to look at these fancy graphs of the layering and the stable coins and all this other stuff going into Chinese, you know, in Mexico and China and all this other precursor stuff. Yeah,
It
so.
is well, like this is why I was so excited to get you on the podcast, because I mean I had a bit of an idea with some of your background and, you know, working for the sort of the three letter agencies in the US was always going to bring a unique sort of skill set. But I think you, what will resonate, one is obviously, you know, the mission. And my God, I can't think of many people that had a role sort of like you and your sort of colleagues where you are dealing with like the horrific side of things. It's like, you know, the folks that are working in sort of child exploitation, people that are working on sort of the dark web stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this is the thing. But this is the thing that, you know, again, why we keep talking about asset recovery, because I think a lot of people, they hear the word asset recovery and they just assume financial crime, or they hear asset recovery and they assume economic crime only. And they think of, you know, these sort of, you know, the harmless fraud and the Ponzi scheme and the person who's stealing from the government and things like that, and don't realize it's all of these things from terrorist financing in any way they can make money, move things, move assets. And the asset recovery is the, you know, I think the four Ds, you know, deny, deter, disrupt. I think the fourth one will come to me. But it's understanding that it's a tool, but it can also do a lot of things on the back end, because the very money that's recovered can then go back into things like drug rehabilitation. It can be reused by sort of state and locals and different campaigns. And you've reminded me actually, at the time of recording this, just a couple of weeks ago, was the big UNODC Basel Institute sort of 9 CRC, the big event. Maybe I think you might have been online to watch it. And there was a phenomenal presentation, a few actually talking about a lot of the focus is now in educating people around sort of fentanyl and, you know, going from the days of, you know, poppy fields in the sort of the Middle East and things like that to now just being, you know, anyone with a sort of pop-up lab. And I get just all of the synthetic side, and knowing that just how easy and sort of infinitely scalable it is on a local level. And then you throw in things like it's no longer complicated dark web where you have to be a mini programmer. Like most normal people couldn't go on, like 20 years ago or 10, 15 years ago, normal people couldn't go on to like Tor browsers and understand how to navigate that. But nowadays you can use Telegram and you can use Snapchat and you can pretty much get, and as you talked about, like the presentation was going through all the different code words so that people can pretty much hide in plain sight and advertise quite blatantly. You know, opioids and sort of fentanyl available, and then almost the different brands of fentanyl available, and just crazy, crazy things. And even like a reference number that you can use. I just find it so interesting, but also sort of keeps me awake at night a little bit as well, because you just realize how much we don't know. Like the scale of the unknown is absolutely terrifying. But if I can take you back to sort of the postal service part, because I think that we just sort of skirted around it a little bit in a nice way, that, you know, realizing it was kind of like that first epiphany when, you know, when I found out why is IRSCI doing all of these cases? Because in my world, it's like they're a tax agent, and I come from criminal.
Yeah.
There's always the cliche, because I was the same. I worked in a criminal investigation team within Revenue and Customs in the UK, but I was a civil investigator. And it was because Al Capone effect. We were trying to use path of least resistance to go after terrible, terrible criminals. And tax was always the angle. So am I right in saying, without oversimplifying it, simply because someone's buying something on the dark web, because it's being posted, you have jurisdiction. So, you know, the Postal Service can get involved. Like you say, you know, any sort of fraud, anything that is using the postal system in any way or shipping way, that gives you guys the jurisdiction. And that's why then you play such an important part on those task forces, because there's maybe, is it additional offences or is it additional access to warrants that make you, what would you say if you were pitching why the Postal Service is as an important partner in law enforcement, what do you notice that Postal Service can do maybe differently that other agencies aren't able to do?
Oh, yes, they would be very happy to tell you, because we have raw data that we do not like to share that is specific to, you know, we have all the mail data. So we could look at all your mail history. We could analyze it and tell you if it's consistent with illicit activity. So we have that data that none of the other agencies have. That sounds like a pitch, but it also sounds like, you know, sometimes we have trouble also sharing. That's the thing. Like, you know, like the React team and Aaron West and all these like post 9/11 when we're supposed to share more. But the reality is maybe we don't share as much as we do. But yes, I mean, you know, these folks are using the postal service still to this day. And some of them are silly enough to actually put label numbers on there. And so we are pulling these labels and we're, you know, identifying them that way. We're also using crypto to, you know, additionally identify these folks and put all of those things together to really have a solid case when they go to court. Yeah.
When you say using crypto, are you talking about sort of using crypto sort of covertly? So using it for a test transaction to buy something, do you mean? Or as in blockchain analytics and mapping out like the money flow?
That's what I do. So I use blockchain to show, you know, the sources of the funds and the flow of the funds. And with these cases so far, when it comes to me, my job as a liaison with this task force, there's a stereotype, you know, and it hasn't gotten, which I'm surprised about, it has not gotten more complicated as block, you know, a cross-chain activity and all this. Mm-hmm. You don't see that as much. That happens when I'm working it with Operation Shamrock victims. That's when it gets convoluted. But with these folks, they're still using Bitcoin for the most part. And they are, you know, it's very typical to see like the Peel chain and, you know, sometimes, well, dusting not as often. But, you know, the very typical way of the criminals.
Yeah, they're not using sophisticated methodologies.
Right.
And maybe that was, again, if anyone hasn't went back and watched, because I know that the day one from the UNODC, the 9CRC event is available to watch online, and all the videos are on YouTube. A plug for that is that when you actually see and hear sort of the insights from the people who are in the weeds going through this, like you mentioned, there is this assumption that, you know, everybody involved in in crypto nowadays are using the most advanced methodologies and they're all using mixers and it must all be super, super complicated. And then one of the speakers was talking about, you know, with the rise of scam factories, with the rise of just the sheer scale of the sort of stuff that, you know, that Aaron and Up Shamrock is highlighting, there's also places and literally universities that you can go to in East and West Africa where you can train to be a scammer. You actually pay a fee and you get a playbook. So that's what you're talking about, where they'll follow a particular pattern because they're literally being taught. This is how you take the money off them. This is how you launder it. This is how you move it around. But what you're saying is like the traditional drug buys, dark web purchases, things like that. Maybe they're going with the old narcotics method of, they're only going to spot 1 in 10. They're only going to spot 1 in 50. They're only going to spot 1 in 100. So it's interesting. I think some people will be surprised by that you're still seeing the.
I'm surprised by that.
Non-sophisticated laundering. Let's call it that.
Yes. Yeah. And so, but again, this is more with so Sarah Graham was one of those people presenting at that conference.
Yeah.
And she, I talked to her a few, we're working together on something very similar. She does exactly what I do. And I happened to see like a link about some fentanyl sprint that Chainalysis and Coinbase did together. And I was like, hey, can we talk about this? So we, you know, exchanged ideas and stuff. But, you know, those rogue vendors that are sort of doing it on their own, the smaller operations, tend to have that pattern. But of course, again, like I mentioned, if you're looking at the bigger precursor, pharmaceutical stuff and, the cartels, bigger operations. Now that gets convoluted and you can absolutely still see the same pattern of, anti-money laundering with the layering. Mm. It just takes more time to put it into a nice graph. Not too long ago, I attended an Elliptic webinar. Now those folks, they have... they had two PhD folks on there who were data science and, you know, one of them teaches about cryptocurrency at a university. And his graphs, he called it the butterfly effect because they do get just so convoluted with these Cambodian syndicates and all these other places in Southeast Asia. And when you're doing these, when you're doing the tracing on the blockchain analytics tools, it looks crazy. Yeah. You know, 3 years, 2021, my daughter came in the room and I had just been, you know, doing stuff on Chainalysis. And she saw it and she said, that looks like a spider web. And it's so true, you know, and then you have to clean it up. So it is under our purview because they are using the post office to mail stuff. And so it's fair game for us to look into what we're doing.
Yeah, it's the same with them. I remember the Secret Service and meeting some of the Secret Service guys, and they're like, anything, like, it's like, what's your jurisdiction if it involves the US dollar? Like, that's a pretty broad, and that's why, because most people would be like, why are the Secret Service? Because again, if you're not from the US, probably some people in the US as well, you just have this thing of, you know, protecting presidents and protecting the foreign diplomats and officials, and that's always like the cliche movie version.
It's
the same with the US. The same with the US, yeah. Yeah, well, there you go. And you should, that's actually quite comforting if you're coming from a US law enforcement background and you thought that. But I think it is fascinating that you've got all of these different sectors, you've got all of these different backgrounds, you've got all of these insanely different portfolios, but we're all still sort of working towards the same conclusion of, you know, disrupting, taking assets off people, taking capital off them, getting it reinvested and sort of disrupting their enterprises. But what do you think, having had the hindsight of those very different roles going in, I think it was Daniel from Europol had mentioned at 9CRC, someone he was asked, you know, like are you worried about mixers and worried about all of this sort of stuff? And he's like, no, and I love this answer. He says, no, I'm more worried about the fact that we are like, you know, 10, 15 years into this and still a lot of agencies aren't taking it seriously at all. Don't have crypto here, don't have crypto team, haven't trained people in crypto investigations. So he's still looking at it. Do you see the same? And sort of what's your views when you're asked, you know, about, you know, with hindsight now, like, where do you think we are as a sort of global community on the sort of the crypto asset recovery, like, you know, readiness sort of scale?
Well, at the postal level, I'm happy to share some very good news to restore faith in humanity, because we have, and I'm very impressed with this agency, and not because I work for them, because I know all these other agencies, and I can tell you they have been staying on top of it. Their forfeiture and seizure SOPs, I've read them. I am very impressed because, you know, when I first heard about Asset Reality and I was interested in, because I don't get to see what happens after I submit the report. And I don't know what they're using and what they're doing. So I got into that and that opened up a conversation. Very wonderful. And, you know, they've always had a robust team with the cryptocurrency tracing and using, you know, different tools, the big ones, you know, Chainalysis and TRM. So, but on a global scale, I think, and I made a list because I'm all over the place. There's so much you could say about crypto, but the issue with crypto is, you know, multifold, right? So there's the vulnerability to cyber, you know, hacks. That's a big one, really big one. But within that, once you get hacked, you know, like with the Bitfinex, which I don't like the pronunciation of that. I think it should be Finex, shouldn't it be
Finex? Finex.
After the hack took place, and I took notes here from the documentary, the losses were generalized or socialized across all accounts, so not just the people who are victims of the hack. So now everybody has to suffer, but that's not enough. It's at 36%. And then after they try to give you an IOU in form of a token, a BFX token. So it's one token, is a dollar. And then they move to offering an option of equity stakes with a recovery rights token, RRT. So that's another issue, you know, where that would dissuade people from crypto, I think, hearing about how it can be hacked. Billions of dollars could be lost. But not just that, if you are actually invested, you know, now the exchange itself or the service is not required to give you anything back, really. They can just do whatever they want.
We see a lot of that on our side of the fence. You know, we act for government agencies, we act for insolvency practitioners. And it is like, I know that you see like the shock when people find out, because they haven't, you know, gone into the T's and C's a lot of times when they're dealing with whether it's DeFi protocols, whether it's regular exchanges, and obviously some of the really big institutional exchanges who are regulated, you know, have kind of, they walk and talk and act like banks. So a lot of them you are pretty much covered, but with so many of them, as you say, you're at the mercy of what happens in those critical times, usually in a war room when something goes wrong. And we've seen a whole range. We've seen where, and in some cases where assets have been lost, it's a case of, as you said, we call it sort of in specie. So you lost one Bitcoin, you're getting one Bitcoin back. We've also seen other cases where they've said you lost the equivalent of $65,000 worth of crypto assets. So mm-hmm. 3 years later, you're getting back $65,000 worth of crypto, whereas it could be worth $250,000 now. And all of these things are being tested in court. There's no absolutely guaranteed like legislative way. They're all different methodologies. And I think often, as you said, people only learn the hard way when it all goes terribly, terribly wrong. Staying on that vein, where do you think, and what's your own, not the views of the Postal Service, but Tara's views, what's your views on Bitcoin ATMs and crypto ATMs? Huge topic in the US at the moment.
Unnecessary. There is just no need for it. Absolutely no need for it. Crypto is...
A woman after my own heart. I said something very similar on LinkedIn a couple of days ago.
Absolutely no reason for it. And that's another thing with crypto ATMs that made the headlines. So optics are, very much play a big role in this. And I think optics were discussed in one of your podcasts, I believe. I remember hearing about that. But they don't talk about, I think it was Allison Jimenez that said something in a post about how that is a drop in comparison to the losses that we don't see in once it hits an exchange.
So Allison's obviously been on this podcast, and I know, for those that don't know, Allison had pointed out, and I think this has been a recurring theme in sort of blockchain reporting, is that we can often say with confidence what something is. Like, if I look at 100 addresses and 25 have interacted with dark web, I can say those 25 are absolutely illicit. So I can, but does that mean 25% of them are illicit? It means no. 25, absolute minimum 25%. The other 75, I don't know. They could be empty, they could be ledger wallets right now that we don't know are currently sitting in a scam compound, and they just haven't interacted with anything to be clustered or attributed. And Allison made a really good point about, like, this is the base level. This is the height of it. It's like, this is just one of the things we absolutely know about. Yeah. From those that don't know, from the US perspective, is it the ATM piece still being dealt with on a sort of state by state level? There still hasn't, and I'm conscious the new administration is very pro crypto. But do you see that sort of like in Washington DC, are they popping up everywhere, or is it a case of there, it's a sort of state by state issue?
Well, I have faith in, Shamrock is really making some advances here in making that like a across the U.S. issue, as opposed to like one, states, just at the local enforcement level. I actually got to see one myself the other day for the first time, a local deli here in Maryland. And I thought, well, what is the point of having this here? At a deli. And it's brand new. Bitcoin Depot, I think, is the big one. There is absolutely no need for them. They are just there to confuse the elderly, and these people are getting scammed out of it because that's all they know, is they've seen ATMs before. So
I think it preys on vulnerabilities, that there's almost an air of legitimacy. Because no, it's a machine and it's inside a reputable store where there's an owner, and it almost creates like a real world connection that people assume, well, if it goes wrong, I'll just contact the operator or I'll contact the company. And the podcast that just has been published this week was Rich LaBelle from Track. And they obviously have lots of data. And it is irrefutable. If the majority of the customers are, and I think he was looking at, they did a project and it was something like the vast majority was like 65 to like 85. The oldest victim was like 94 years old. Mm-hmm. And they're going like, it's not that people just in twilight years are deciding, hey, I'm going to get into crypto through an ATM. It's like, no, you would just go and open an exchange account and you'd go and buy and trade digital assets if that's what you wanted to do. These sadly usually are very one way. So just scam related transactions. And you mentioned Shamrock there. Like, what do you think is the, not necessarily magic wand, But what is it that you think needs to change? You mentioned Postal Service, and obviously for those that don't know, Postal Service were around during the early Silk Road seizure. So as an entity, no, I mean, as an organization, you've been involved at an insanely early stage. What sort of advice do you give when you're speaking to someone, maybe in law enforcement, maybe in state and local level, or someone that's like, hey, you know, our departments kind of were first into this? I mean, what are you saying 2025, where people are sort of getting started? What are still the big challenges? Because all we keep hearing and all we keep seeing on LinkedIn is victim, law enforcement, we can't take on the case. Is it volume? Is it resources? Is it tools? Is it training? What's your take on it?
The answer is, the answer of everyone else you've interviewed so far is all of the above. I don't want it to sound like, you know, so pessimistic and sad, but there are changes and there are some really good people out there who are taking time, you know, not even their job, to like volunteer hours. These are people who are skilled, who are trying to train everyone else at the, you know, local and state level, to prepare them better for these, for this scandemic, you know, and that's one part of it. You know, fighting the scamdemic. And then there's the making crypto relevant and, you know, easy to understand to the public in general, like differentiating between the, you know, it's only, you said the numbers are not accurate, but 1% only is illicit. Crypto is cryptography is wonderful. I come from the NSA, you know, it is probably the best technological invention, you know, protection, security. It's wonderful. It's immutable. It's all there, visibility.
Yeah, so the reason we can make calls and send messages and send emails and send transactions around the world, you know, pre-virtual assets is cryptography. And let's jump in there just quickly, because you've reminded me. We try and always get across on the podcast with a number of guests, but you've really embodied it, that it's just another new technology threat. Like, in the same way what you were doing in the past, you had to deal with and figure out, I mean, this, you know, ISIS threat and what they were doing. And maybe there's a different data set that you can go to find information, but ultimately it's still, you know, gathering data, building a case, identifying your suspects. Like, would you share that sort of view, that it's the latest thing, and in 10 years time there'll be another thing, but yeah, crypto isn't bad, it's just being used by bad people?
Exactly. And I think, is it Ari or Ari? I hear both. I haven't
Ari.
Met him.
Oh, yeah.
Ari. I think we would say Ari, yes. But, you know, he was talking about cell phones and pagers from back in the day.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
That crypto is just another element to cases now, you know, in investigations, criminal investigations, financial investigations, because, you know, they go hand in hand. Cyber criminals are using, you know, the blockchain. And so, yeah, it's just a new thing. And I think the data is there. The tools have improved. I mean, I can't tell you like how much easier it's become with just like Chainalysis and TRM since 2021, when I started, when it was more manual for us to just sit and trace through everything ourselves and not sure of what it is. And now it automatically flags things for you. It traces across, you know, the different chains. And so that's made that a lot, it saved a lot of hours, because, you know, when it comes to, you know, talking about resources, so just more efficient. Even if we still have the same small number of investigators, at least now they can do more with their time. And so we're, you know, it's an improvement, it's a work in progress. And regulation, I mean, everyone's just so excited about crypto with this administration. We just have to also make sure that, you know, regulation is up to speed with how fast it's moving. And it is. There are, again, a lot of really good people out there who are making sure that we do regulate, you know, not just here, but globally. You know, because the UK has had MiCA for a while now. They have stricter regulations. And so exchanges and all these other folks are not as comfortable with.
Yeah, you've got, just for people that don't know, you've now got, I don't know, Thanks. The UK, obviously, you know, post-Brexit, you have sort of the EU with this sort of new MiCA regulation, which is like the big, big standard. And there's good things in there. There's things like the Digital Operational Resilience, DORA. So like asset reality, we're a custodian. So for governments only and sort of asset recovery practitioners only, but having to go through things like resilience audits, because the old standards like SOC 2, I mean, SOC 2 is great, but a one-man consultancy can get SOC 2. That it doesn't go into things like disaster recovery, private key backups. It doesn't go into those things. So a lot of the things that emerged during FTX and other big collapses have informed future regulation. But it's kind of why regulation always has to run behind, because it's kind of like something gets launched, terrible things happen, the regulators step in. It's the same cycle in everything. We build cars, people drive them too fast. Hey, speed limits. People drive fast and crash. Hey, airbags. It's always going to happen sort of after the event. And the UK is in an in-between spot, coming under a lot of criticism at the minute because it has a registration program for companies. Asset Reality is registered with the FCA, for example. But there isn't that. The regulatory roadmap has been set out, but it hasn't come into power yet. And then obviously in the US, you've got almost the exact opposite. You've got certain things with stable coins, certain things with regulation, but not what we were all expecting maybe a year ago, where it seemed like it was going to be cracking down on things. Now there's not really that sort of enforcement. It's more about enabling. And I think that fundamentally that's why we'll be having these types of conversations probably for years and decades to come, because you've got all of these different things happening all around the world. But then asset recovery is asset recovery. I mean, there's no borders for criminals. There's no money laundering doesn't have sort of conventional borders. They don't care about regulators. And it's always this sort of, we have to do it one way and they can do it another way. And I think that's what's always going to lead to this just insanely complicated sort of constant battle that's never going to change. What if you had your magic wand for a day, what is the one bit of advice, the one thing you would change, the thing that grates on you the most in your experience, or the thing that's done well but it's not done well enough to put you on the spot, what would that be?
I like to play devil's advocate, and with our new, with the administration, how they've just been very pro crypto. Wonderful. I've attended so many events this year with people who are, fintech startups, so many. And I attended one in DC where there's, two offices in DC that are now just really focused on getting more fintech startups out of DC. And so that
which is good, which is good for the economy, good for jobs.
Right. Yeah, it's great. And so I do like the US's drive and, for innovation. That's the argument is, in Europe, maybe it's stifling innovation when you have so many regulations, right?
Yeah.
And in some ways, that is true. I mean, we do have a lot more startups. And so, but we rely on the private sector more to provide us with the regulatory framework ideas. They're the ones who are going to make suggestions to Congress about what we should be looking into. Circle's done that. All these other big ones have done that. And they're the ones lobbying. So I guess I was against it and I was apprehensive at first, but now I can see it working. And I think just like with anything, like you said, new technology, I think we will catch up. But yeah, regulation will always be a step behind. But I think we're getting better about it. And in terms of like the scamdemic itself, I think we're getting better about, spreading awareness, providing those resources, making sure that the folks who are already doing these cases have more time. They're more efficient with their time to get, more cases. And then, there's the whole, we're not even going to touch asset seizure because that,
what's that? Talk me through it. Sounds interesting.
Yeah. And, for us at Postal, it's only administrative. There's civil, criminal, and administrative. Mm-hmm. And you don't know who decided this and why for each agency. And so, very complex. But
well, and obviously, well, what's going to play out obviously is the impact as well in the US, because regardless of who the seizing agency is, what still remains unclear is what is this executive order on a strategic reserve stockpile going to look like? Because conventionally, it would have been Postal Service, FBI seizes an asset, off to the US Marshals as the DOJ, and then the DOJ, their contractor would liquidate the assets, was the normal flow. And now everyone sort of around the world is waiting to see what's going to happen. Is there going to be, I think they said in the last guidance, there's going to be a team at Treasury and they're going to manage a reserve and there's going to be a stockpile and it's going to be neutral. It's only going to be made up of forfeited assets. But then that brings in a whole bunch of questions, because forfeiture is used to fund law enforcement. So now it's not going to, it's like you're taking the money. It's not going to generate revenue. You're taking money from one place and that money is going to have to be backfilled somewhere else. So it is, it is fascinating. It's the reason we exist from the asset forfeiture side. And the reason we've just announced our partnership with Up Shamrock was around, even just from a productivity and a resource point of view, if we can do our bit and help people build their asset seizure infrastructure, build their wallet infrastructure, build their reporting databases, their management information that they need just to run their cases, whether it goes to a reserve, whether it gets liquidated, whether it goes to a victim, even that, so you don't have officers with lots of spreadsheets and SOPs and wallets, gives people back a little bit of time. Like you said, the blockchain analytic tools give you back time because you're not having to manually go. Sorry to ask you the cliche AI question, but you were just saying there, the tools are so much different. Like what's the average investigator and someone with your expertise in sort of inhumant in that world as well? If someone was sitting down today to start a new job in an agency dealing with cases involving crypto, what is that typical toolkit that someone is using as of sort of 2025?
The big ones are still Chainalysis and TRM. Is that what you mean?
But in terms of blockchain analytics, what other, we've seen lots of other companies start, and not even necessarily companies, but the OSINT that comes into that as well, in addition to blockchain analytic tools, just to give people a bit of a sneak peek as to what an investigator is actually looking into.
Yeah, well, and hopefully they're using their own tools and data, which is very helpful. Each agency has something unique. CBP probably has all of the data that we want. It's insane what they have. And so if somebody's CBP...
That's Customs and Border for the non-US folks, yeah.
This big HSI is this huge conglomerate now with CBP and ICE and everything. An agency like that, where they have much better funding. They are able to get all the new tools, whether it's blockchain analytics or open source, and they have all the data already available. And so that would make for a very efficient investigation, because all you have to do is, if you have a crypto address, you're going to look it up, trace it, and then hopefully hit an exchange that is LE friendly, they subpoena, they get the KYC, and they go from there. Or, in their own data, they already have maybe seized data from dark web markets like we do. And so if we get a hit on that, it'll show, a vendor account, and we take it from there. So the tools are there and the data is there, depending on which agency and which set of data you might have. And that's, the thing is, like, if we work better together with all the agencies like I do with the task force, it's wonderful, because we bring all these, and it's not just across agencies, but we also work with Europol a lot and Eastern Europe, all sorts of governments. When they seize these servers, dark web, market servers, they share the data with us, and that's invaluable.
Yeah. Well, we saw the announcement with Project Asset at Europol as well. And it is really comforting to see that there is so much proactive, almost like lead generation, case building.
And yes, remember that. Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah. It really is. So don't lose faith. And, now it's a tough time of the year and with the shutdown and all this speculation.
You're all still working. You're all still working. That's the main thing. You're not kicking back with a margarita on a Wednesday.
No, we're still working. We're still helping victims, and the mission is the most important thing. So, yeah.
Well, I think that is a perfect spot to end on. Tara, I'm so grateful for you sort of walking us through. We have such a broad range of guests coming into this. And I wasn't even aware of some of the backstories that you were telling me. And it is a reminder that crypto will cross your desk. Doesn't matter what background you're in, doesn't matter what department or agency you're in. At one of the recent events we were at, one of the speakers from some of the big banks were just saying, like crypto is finance. It's not crypto or finance anymore. It's going to turn up in the same way stocks and shares turn up. Crypto is going to turn up. Digital assets are going to turn up and fiat is going to turn up and real estate is going to turn up. It's just another thing that's just going to be ever present. So hopefully we can check in a year's time or so and we can hear the progress and see what the new things are coming down the line. But thank you so much for taking the time to share this today. And I will see you on the road with Op Shamrock, I'm sure.
Yes, absolutely. I'm so excited. I saw that. And so congratulations. Two of my, like I said, I think I commented as like two of my favorite worlds collide. So I'm very happy to see that. Yeah. And it was great to be here.
Thank you so much.
Our podcasts are for informational purposes only. They are not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, and/or investment advice. Listeners must consult their own advisors before making any decisions on the topics being discussed.